Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What up and happy Thanksgiving, everyone. It's the Crossover Pod Friday edition. Hope you all had a wonderful holiday. I'm Howard Beck, senior writer for Sports Illustrated. My guest today is Dan Grunfeld. He is the author of By the Grace of the Game, The Holocaust, A Basketball Legacy, and An Unprecedented American Dream. If you recognize the name, that's because Dan is, of course, the son of Ernie Grunfeld, the former GM of the Knicks and Bucks and Suns. He also, of course, was a former NBA player for 9 seasons, and in fact, the only NBA player to be the son of Holocaust survivors. It's a fascinating story and one that had never been told before, even though Ernie Grunfeld, of course, has spent most of his adult life in the public spotlight. And Ernie will actually join us for the last 15 minutes of the conversation. Dan is telling this story for the first time in this book. It's a very difficult story, obviously, and certainly one that was very difficult for his father. It almost fell to Dan to be the one to carry this forth. It's gripping, it's moving, and of course there is darkness and tragedy in their family history, but this is mostly a tale of hope and perseverance. You see it in Ernie Grunfeld's life through Dan's eyes in the book and through the stories passed down from Dan's grandmother, who escaped the Holocaust and eventually moved to the U.S. There's a lot of fun basketball stuff along the way too. So the book really, I think, does a great job of alternating, giving us some of the history and some of those tough moments, but also a lot of insights into Ernie Grunfeld's basketball journey, Dan Grunfeld's journey as well. He played at Stanford for 4 years and played a little overseas. I highly recommend the book. It's officially out December 7th, but available for pre-order in all the usual places. Go get it. It'd be a great gift for yourself or anybody in your family. Before we get to our guests, a quick reminder, please rate, review, and subscribe to The Crossover wherever you get your podcasts. Hit me with all your feedback on Twitter, @HowardBeck. Okay, my conversation with Dan Grunfeld and Ernie a little later is coming up next, so stick around.
This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
Now, very pleased to be joined by the author of By the Grace of the Game, The Holocaust, A Basketball Legacy, and An Unprecedented American Dream, Dan Grunfeld. Dan, how are you, sir? Welcome.
Howard, it's great to be with you, man.
It's great to be with you. Who could have known in 2008 when you and I met I don't know. Were we in Greenberg at the Knicks practice facility? Was it in Saratoga Springs? I just, you and I met briefly a long time ago when you were in Knicks camp as a prospect, and I was covering the Knicks as a beat writer for the New York Times. Here we are all these years later. You have a book. I am several gigs later. You're a father with another on the way. Congratulations.
Thank you.
It is wild how you know life you know creates these intersections and all along the way. It's fun getting this opportunity to have you on my podcast all these years later. When in 2008 when we met, I don't think I knew what a podcast was. So.
Well, listen, I'm happy to be here. And also, we have the Golden State Warriors to thank, right? Because they made the finals so many years, and I'm living in the Bay Area. And so we got to see each other there, too. So they kept the thread alive.
Yes, the thread was kept alive because I would halftime at Warriors finals games when they were at Oracle, and I would just pace around. I just needed to get my legs stretched and find some coffee somewhere on those really tight old-ass concourses. And you and I would invariably run into each other randomly. It was amazing.
It became a tradition.
It became a very strange tradition. We'd run into each other at various NBA things. But great to see you. Congratulations on this book. It's phenomenal. It's powerful. And it is, you know, as I referenced the fact that we met each other so many years ago, I did not know anything about, you know, obviously I knew who your father, Ernie Grunfeld, was when I came to New York to start covering the Knicks. He had moved on by that time. I think he was in Milwaukee. Which is, I'm sure, where you were at the time, too. I did not know anything about your family's history regarding the Holocaust, that your father is essentially or literally the only NBA player in history whose parents survived the Holocaust. You and I have known each other all these years, and until you let on about the book maybe a year or two ago when we were talking, I had no idea about this. But the book, there is sorrow and horror and tragedy, but also joy and hope and a pervasive optimism and a resilience. It's amazing. There's also a lot of basketball in there. So I don't even know where to begin with it all, except I guess from the beginning, which is you obviously carried all of this with you, the basketball part of it and your father's legacy, his family's legacy. And at some point, I guess there becomes an urgency to put this all down. I know, you know, being middle-aged myself, like there are certain things you realize at a certain point, we have certain responsibility and things that you start to lose as your family gets older. Was there a moment where you thought, you know what, there is this whole untold story here and a really important and poignant one? When does that hit you? When do you decide like you've got to be the one to kind of bring this to the fore?
It was really towards the end of my professional basketball career. You know, so I played collegially at Stanford, 8 years professionally, and I finished my career in Israel. You know, and I write about that at length in the book, and that was really an important experience for me, kind of a coming full circle moment for our family and learning more about the story. Of course, you know, my grandmother, who's the central figure of the book, and, you know, she's a Holocaust survivor. She's a very big story. I'm 96 years old today, living in the Bay Area, doing amazing. I mean, she is the best, but just kind of, you know, being around her, learning what happened, getting older. And then once I retired from playing, I went back to Stanford to get my MBA, and I had a little bit of space to explore other things. You know, when you're playing hoops, there's, you know, I did a lot of writing and I would write articles for websites, but you know, when you're writing a book, it's, you know, you have to be all in on that. And so it was really when I retired, I had learned more of the story. My grandma had kept telling me more and more that I said, okay, now's the time. I want to tell this.
And by the way, I should just note, because I've devoted my whole professional career to writing, you're an MBA who also played in the NBA. The writing is fantastic, Dan. Like, this is a great book.
Thank you.
I spent my whole life doing this, and I'm not writing anything nearly as poignant as what I've read in these pages, and I really mean that. Phenomenally done. Did the stories that your grandmother told you, was there a certain moment in your life where you really started to appreciate your family's path in a way that you know, obviously as kids, you know, we're so unaware of everything. But do you remember when some of these stories about how your family arrived in the U.S. and the circumstances and what your grandmother had survived? When do you recall that kind of coalescing as something that was a defining aspect of your family?
I don't think I understood the gravity of it all until I got older. But I'll tell you, even as a young kid, I sensed it and I knew, and it was so related to basketball because, you know, my grandma, we're so close, you know, to this day, we talk on the phone every day. We FaceTime with my son every day. And she would talk about her family who are no longer here. And I just had this sense of this great tragedy, but also this amazing triumph from my dad's basketball career and how unlikely it was and how improbable it was and what a miracle really it was for our family. So, and I write about this very candidly in the book. I felt a lot of pressure as a result of that, you know, because when you carry that history and when the game has done that much for your family, you want to live up to that. You want to carry that forward. And so, you know, that was part of my journey with basketball. But I always had a sense. But again, as I got older and as I learned more and more, I really just said to myself, you have to tell the story because I think it's universal. You know, we all can understand perseverance, overcoming adversity, survival, the love of family. And these are really the themes of the story.
And it's very much, you know, among other things, it's very much the classic American immigrant story as well, which I think a lot of people can relate to. No matter how your family arrived here, people have some similar, you know, touchstones in their family's history. We should set the table here. I mean, give me the you know, or for the listeners, the basic circumstances here. Where your grandmother grew up. You know, how old she was when the Holocaust, you know, kind of starts to unfold, and you know how it brings, you know, her family and ultimately your father to the U.S.
Without a doubt, and I'll tell you, as it relates to the Holocaust, you know, I've been telling a lot of people recently, it wasn't that long ago, and it wasn't that far away, and so I'm about to recount a history that seems, you know, it seems almost like an abstraction because it's so unbelievable and unfathomable. But as I said, my grandmother is alive and well and doing amazing. She came to every single home game I played at Stanford. You know, this story that seems so incredible in history, you know, it's really more relevant than we think. And so my grandmother was born in Transylvania, so on the border of Romania and Hungary, in a small village, Orthodox Jewish family. 10 siblings, there was 10 of them. So she had 9 siblings, 2 loving parents. And, you know, I did a year and a half of research on the book. So I was, you know, I asked every question imaginable, really trying to get a sense of what was it like for my grandmother before the war? What was it like for my dad after the war growing up under communism in Romania? But by all accounts, my grandmother's childhood was idyllic. I mean, they didn't have technology, they didn't have running water, but they had love and laughter and family. And it was, you know, it was really a beautiful way to grow up. And when the Nazis invaded, she happened to be visiting a sister in Budapest. And they got a letter immediately from their father that said, come home. And they packed their suitcases and they had made plans to go to the train station. Right before they left, the next day, they got another letter that said, if you can, stay where you are. And my grandma, to this day, says that's what saved her from Auschwitz. She thinks that her father realized his daughters would have a better chance of surviving in a big city. And so my great-grandfather was my grandmother's hero, and that was the last communication they ever had. So he was taken to Auschwitz, and he was killed. His name was Solomon, and my son is named Solomon after him. You know, so these stories and these values really continue. But my grandma had a chance to survive on the run, and she was saved twice in Budapest by Swedish diplomat Raoul Wallenberg, who's considered one of the greatest heroes of the Holocaust, credited for saving roughly 100,000 Jews, and my grandmother was one of them. And he saved her life twice. Once by issuing protective passports, which, by the way, my grandma risked her life to obtain 17 passports for other people. So I say often she's my hero, but she's also a hero. And that's the truth. Wallenberg also saved her by convincing the commander of the Budapest ghetto not to kill the remaining 80,000 inhabitants at the end of the war, which is something my grandma didn't find out until 40 years later. She saw the Nazis in the entrance of the ghetto with machine guns, and they hid in an attic and nothing happened, and she was soon liberated. And it took 40 years when a movie about Wallenberg's life was made to learn that it was him who convinced the commander not to kill them. So he saved her twice.
That's incredible. And remind me, I mean, she lost both of her parents and how many of her siblings?
5 siblings were killed. And so, yeah, both parents killed in Auschwitz, 5 siblings. 3 were killed in Auschwitz, and 2, one was killed on a death march in Budapest. One was killed in a camp in the Ukraine. She had 5 survived, as I said. 2 came to the United States, 3 to Israel.
It's incredible. It's clear in reading the book, Dan, that you obviously have had some many lengthy discussions with your grandmother to garner all this. There's incredible detail and description of her life, of surroundings, of moments, of places. And one, I'm blown away because I can only imagine she's probably the only source for this, which means her memory must be just absolutely incredible. Like, I can't remember what I, you know, ate for breakfast yesterday. But it really does bring it to life. Like, it's very important that obviously you had her not just as a resource, but as somebody who really, she must be an incredible storyteller herself, because the level of detail is just really impressive.
Well, first of all, thank you for that. She's one of a kind. She's unbelievable. She wasn't my only source, because we have cousins in Israel and Hungary. And I mean, I talk to everyone, but she has a memory that's astounding. She really does. And it's a blessing. It's a gift. We did an interview with each other recently where we were being interviewed and someone asked her about her experiences. And she was saying, she was telling the story and she said, yeah, but then on March 18th, 1944, this happened. But then on, and the person interviewing after said, whoa, I said, listen, that's my grandma. That's what you get. Like, she remembers. And the other part about it is, not only does she remember the stories, but she wants to tell them. And that's an important distinction, because a lot of Holocaust survivors, it's too painful to talk about it. And many people don't talk about it. And you have to respect that. But for my grandma, she always says, we need to tell the story, because we need to remember them. You know, we need to remember those who perished. And we need to make sure it never happens again, and not just to Jews, to anybody, you know? And so she, not only does she remember everything, but it's almost an obligation to talk about it.
Did she start telling you these stories just naturally in the course of conversation as you were growing up? Were there moments where actually it's just your own curiosity going to her with it? I'm curious, like, even long before you decided this should be a book, I'm wondering how those discussions across the generations are discussed.
Yeah. She would tell me stories my whole life, you know, and varying levels of detail, but I knew bits and pieces of a lot of the things that had happened. It wasn't until I endeavored to write the book that I dug in and, you know, I double clicked on everything. And so the detail that you read is because I kept, you know, pressing, and she was willing. We just, you know, we would draw more things out, but yeah, she would tell these stories throughout the course of my life. And they were always, you know, sad, meaningful, incredible. You know, some things that happened in the book and happened in my family story, like, you can't make it up. Like, some of the people through history that weaved in and out of the story. And I just kind of grew up hearing about all these really improbable things. And so that's why I said I should write this.
No, absolutely. There's an incredible, very poignant moment with you and your grandmother at the Holocaust Museum in Washington, involving Raoul Wallenberg, who you alluded to earlier. I won't give away the details, but the actor and comedian Buddy Hackett plays a pivotal role. Like, when I saw his name on the page, and I had to double take. Like, wait a minute, this is absolutely just incredible. I don't want to give it away. People go buy the book, but it's wild that Buddy Hackett plays a role in your family. Being able to escape, essentially.
And real quick, and we won't give anything away, but that's a story that I heard growing up. And, you know, when you're a little kid, you go, oh, that's interesting. But then as I got older, I said, what is it? You know, it's just, again, you can't write, you couldn't make it up. It just, you know, things happen, but it's really astounding.
Yeah. So you mentioned, you know, obviously she was not your only source. You're speaking to other family members around the world. Were they all just as willing to discuss it? Because as you mentioned, you know, for some Holocaust survivors, you know, it is too painful. But you want to get the details right. And there's a lot of detail here. And some of it, I'm sure, was quite painful. So how did you find that as you went from one family member to the next to try to gather these various strands?
Everyone was willing to share what they had and what they knew to contribute to the story. The sad part is that in our family, there are none of the survivors are alive anymore. Actually, a cousin is. I should take that back. Actually, a cousin who was involved in the Buddy Hackett story is still alive in Hungary, and he was willing to talk about, you know, his experiences. But, you know, my grandmother is the last remaining sibling. You know, all her siblings have passed. So, but I was able to talk to my cousins who had the stories of their parents. Mm-hmm. You know, so I write about, I had one great aunt who was the only family member who came back from Auschwitz. And I just knew that she's the one who survived, but I didn't know how, and I didn't know what happened. And so I called my cousin, who I know very well, I'm close with. And when I was playing in Israel, she would have me over for Shabbat dinner and come to all my games. So we're very close. And I just asked her, you know, what's your mom's story? And she had notes, and we went over it all. And so piece by piece, you know, I started understanding what happened to each family member. But yeah, everyone was definitely willing to talk and share.
How much do you think you understand your father differently after going, like, again, obviously this is not new. It's not just that you did the book, but you learn a lot more along the way. Do you have a different sense or understanding of him and your relationship too, having delved this far into it?
Yeah, that it's an understanding. You know, we have an amazing relationship. He's an amazing father, but to know with this level of detail really what it was like, because I always knew that, you know, my dad grew up differently. You know, when I was born, my dad was a player for the Knicks and then the general manager of the Knicks. You know, I was privileged in a lot of ways. I always knew my dad grew up differently, that he went through hard things, and that he became a basketball player. But when you really learn the details of what that means, of a young boy coming to America, not speaking the language, the son of Holocaust survivors, losing a brother, which I'm sure is something we'll get into, and then finding a game out of nowhere that really, and I know what it did for our family because I'm living that. I'm that generation who benefited from what the game did, you know? So just that perspective has really made me understand more, you know, his journey and what the game means to us all.
Your father was 8 when they arrived in the U.S., correct?
That's right.
8 and doesn't speak a word of English. They arrive with no possessions, essentially. How do you think it shaped him? I mean, you know, your father's been in the public eye a long time. Listeners of this podcast, whether they knew him as a player for, I believe, 9 seasons, mm-hmm. Or as the general manager of the Knicks, the Bucks, the Wizards, your dad has a public presence. And I think people, you know, like even my own experience as a reporter, having, you know, intersected with your dad at various times over the years, he's a fairly reticent guy. Like he's really easy to talk to. He's not going to tell you much, right. but he keeps it close to the vest. And I feel like to an extent, reading the book and reading about his youth and growing up here, being different and, you know, immigrant family, everything else, I did kind of feel like, okay, now I think I get Ernie a little bit more in terms of the reticence, maybe. Is it an accurate reading? And do you think that is kind of, you know, why, you know, we see the Ernie Grunfeld that we've seen?
Yeah, I mean, of course, our experiences shape us. And I think going through what he went through, having the success he did with basketball, and the values that he applied to the game, which he learned from my grandparents, which were hard work, you know, head down and work, you know? And so I think some of that reticence is, and it's totally true, and he'd be the first to admit it. You know, he's not the most, in a press conference, he won't be the most gregarious person. He is personally. He's a very warm, outgoing guy. But I think, you know, with that background, it's easier to understand. You know, he made something of himself in America, and my grandparents did the same by putting their head down, working, not really talking that much about it, but more so doing it. And so I think, yeah, the story for so many, his journey for so many reasons impacted him. And it's interesting. I've had a lot of people reach out to me about the book and say, oh, I loved watching your dad play, whether it was at Tennessee or the Knicks or the Bucks or wherever. And they said, and almost across the board, it's been, there wasn't a loose ball he didn't dive on. There wasn't a play he didn't hustle for. He always played with such heart. And I tell him, read the book, you know, you'll get it, because he wasn't fighting for his life anymore. But that's the kind of mentality, right? When you come from this background. And so I think for all those reasons, as a player, as a person, as an executive, yeah, the stories impacted him a lot.
Well, and you mentioned this earlier, so we'll I want to just at least touch on it. But your father was, I believe, 9 when his older brother dies of leukemia. And so there's that part that shapes him too. It's not just the immigrant experience and the Holocaust survivors, you know, of his parents' generation. It's, you know, there's personal tragedy shaping him from a very early stage here too.
100%, and that's, you know, a formative experience, and it's to this day just crushing and sad for our family. And my uncle's name was Lutzi in Hungarian, but Leslie in English, and I'm named after him. My middle name is Leslie, you know, and it's. I write in the book, and it's true. It's a hole that can never be filled. And you know, my dad called his brother in something in Hungarian that is translated means my king. So that just shows, you know, he looked up to him. He was his everything, and he passed away within a year. And so, and that incident, right? My uncle's passing is so closely linked to basketball in our family because, you know, my grandparents are immigrants. They're working, you know, 6-7 days a week. So my dad was a latchkey kid. You know, he locked up the apartment when he left in the morning. He let himself in at night, and that his brother passes. And so he was in Queens, New York. He went to the local park. You know, what do? There? They play hoops. You know, so he just wanted to make friends and learn English, but also to heal from that loss. That's how basketball came into his life.
Yeah. And so you, as you note, then grow up the privileged son of an NBA player and an NBA GM. But you were pretty young, I think, when your dad's playing career ended, right? So do you have any? Yeah. So what did you know as a kid of his playing career as opposed to his executive career? Because there's no YouTube at the time.
No.
I don't know. When did you actually get to see some of your dad's highlights?
I was a basketball fanatic, right? So like I'm always watching tapes and watching the game. And so at a very young age, I was watching any clip I could find. We talked, his career was always brought up. A lot of it was Tennessee, you know, the Ernie and Bernie show and what he did with Bernard King and a little bit in high school as well. Because he was a good NBA player. He was a solid role player. But in high school and in college, he was a phenomenon. I mean, he was one of the most highly recruited players in the country out of high school. You know, he was a four-time first-team All-SEC player at Tennessee. You know, he graduated as the school's all-time leading scorer. And here's a good tidbit for you, Howard. To this day, he's the fifth leading scorer in the history of the SEC.
Wow.
Which is amazing. It's like, you know, 40 whatever years later, even more.
That's amazing.
And listen, part of it is because people don't stay 4 years anymore. But, you know, but still, like, him and Bernard, they each averaged more than 25 points per game one season. You know, it just doesn't happen anymore. And both from New York City. And so
is that when they end up on the SI cover?
That's right. You know, and I had that. I had an enlarged version of that on the wall of my bedroom.
That's awesome.
You know, and by the way, Bernard and my dad played for the Knicks together, and he lived up the street from us. And so I would come home from school, and Bernard would be at our kitchen table with my dad. And, you know, he provided a really great and meaningful quote on the back of the book. But, you know, and that story in and of itself, you know, ESPN made a 30 for 30 about it, was so meaningful. Two guys, you know, Bernard from Brooklyn, my dad from Queens, they have different backgrounds, but they go down to Knoxville and they become legends together. And, you know, it's what, almost 50 years later now, and they still talk on the phone once a month. We were just out in the Bay Area together. My dad stepped out. He came back in a half hour later. We said, "Hey, well, where were you?" He goes, "Oh, Bernard just called." They were just chatting, you know, love to the family, you know. So it's pretty amazing, you know, what they did and, you know, what basketball did at that time for my dad.
It's wild too, Dan, to think about, you know, how we can link together or how closely linked together these eras of the NBA are. It's been a long time since Patrick Ewing retired. Also, quick footnote, I was alluding earlier in the podcast to you and I meeting in 2008. Patrick Ewing Jr. was also in camp with the Knicks that year. It was the two of you, the legacy Knicks in camp briefly. But your dad's, I think, final season was Patrick Ewing's rookie year. So Patrick Ewing, the legend Patrick Ewing, was carrying your dad's bags on the road as part of his rookie hazing.
Yeah, my dad said, Patrick, you know, that was, you know, how it is with veterans and rookies. Yeah. And my dad was, you know, it was his final year, was Patrick's rookie year. And then my dad was the GM of the team when Patrick was, you know, a superstar. So I grew up with little Patrick. We're such close friends even to this day. But Patrick is an all-time legend, amazing, amazing player, great guy. And it just kind of shows what things were like back then. He carried my dad's bag. My dad was a role player. You know, Patrick was on the verge of superstardom, but that's kind of how the league worked.
What's your most vivid memories of being, you know, son of the Knicks GM? Not so much, like I say, the playing days had kind of passed by that point, but you grew up at the Garden. Actually, you have a phenomenal line, which is, I think, the only thing that I decided to type out and put in my notes to make sure that I mentioned from the book, which is that the Garden, quote, had an unmistakable smell, something like pretzels, beer, and thyme. I literally laughed out loud because I think my first year covering the Lakers, 97-98, that was my, every time we'd come to the Garden, it's the only arena that had this distinct smell and feel and everything else. There's an ambiance there too. But I always thought like, man, this place just needs a good scrub down. And then somehow they did a $1 billion renovation, you know, however many years it's been now, 10 years ago, and it still somehow smells the same. That's incredible. Yeah.
But that's the charm of it, you know, and I could almost still smell it. And yeah, I did it in so many ways grow up in that building, and it's so cool, you know, being a kid, being able to run around the Garden. I mean, I remember rebounding for Michael Jordan and the Bulls, you know, before a game, and just being in the locker room and seeing players. It's amazing. I've told this story a few times recently. One of my something I'll never forget is, I think it was probably 97, 98, around that time when the Knicks and the Heat had this, you know, crazy rivalry, right, with Tim Hardaway and Alonzo Mourning for the Heat. And then it was Larry Johnson and Allen Houston were with the Knicks by that point, and of course Patrick. And before one of those playoff games, you know, for me, I felt like I was playing in the playoff game before, right? So I'm getting ready and I'm all excited. And usually I sat up at the top of the arena in a box with my dad, but I happened to be sitting with my mom, who's had, you know, good seats. She was, you know, this is the GM's family seats. And the players are getting ready for the jump and they're giving each other fist pounds. And I happen to be standing up just because I was like focused, you know, getting ready for the game in my way. And Allen Houston walked towards me. And I knew Allen, of course, because, you know, my dad's a GM of the team. And we made eye contact. And he just looked at me and he gave me a nod, you know, like, let's do this. And I nodded at him. And then he turned back and I sat and I looked at our family friends. Did you see that? You know, and it was like, it was just the coolest thing. I don't even remember what happened in the game because, like, that was just the coolest thing. So moments like that, you know?
The New York media, of course, is infamously brutal at times, especially the tabloids. The New York Times, of course, we handled everything with utmost respect. And
thank you for that.
So, yes. But the New York media in general, especially the tabloids, can be tough. You're growing up the kid of the Knicks GM, and you know, there's all the ups and downs that go along the way. You tell a story in the book of reporters calling your house. They're trying to trick you into, mm-hmm. like, giving away what your dad's working. Oh, it's like, my God, ridiculous. By the way, you don't throw anybody under the bus in there. There's nobody by name. If you want to throw any New York media members under the bus in this podcast, feel free.
Safe space.
It's a safe space. I was very curious. And immediately my mind starts turning like, who would have been trying to trick, like, you know, 10-year-old Dan Grunfeld into, like, giving away his dad's, you know, trade secrets, literally.
Right.
what was it like just to see? Because any given day, you're either hero or goat in this city. Could you see it take a toll? Or is that part of his reticence that maybe he wouldn't give away how that was affecting him? But it must have been an interesting experience through your eyes.
It was. And I think, you know, being a leader of a sports team, particularly in New York, there's a lot of pressure. There are a lot of expectations. You sign up for it in a sense when you do that job. And my dad did that job for 30 years, you know, in different markets. So we're very accustomed to that. At the same time, no one would say that's a pleasant human experience, you know, because at the end of the day, we're all human beings. And you hope that we'd try to treat each other with kindness and compassion and understanding. That those are the last things that you get at, you know, in the sports media landscape. And that's just kind of the way it goes. And so I think my dad has very thick skin. Given his history of what he went through, what he accomplished, how he went about it, he's always put his head down and worked. And he always told me that if you just work, you know, and you do the best you can and you work and you put your time in, you know, the results are going to be what they're going to be. And particularly when you run a team, because so much of it is out of your control, you never know exactly how things are going to go. But that is kind of the other side of the experience, you know, where it's so fun to be at the Garden. But yeah, you wake up in the morning and your dad's on the front page of the paper and someone's writing about why he should lose his job, you know. But a month later, he was the hero of the city because they had won 5 straight, but now they've lost 6 out of 7, you know. It's that kind of thing. So you kind of get a sense of none of it is really real, you know. You don't want to read too much into the great things or the negative things. Just want to stay even keeled. And I think it also makes you kind of insular as a family because there is so much pressure and there is so much criticism and expectations that, you know, you rely on each other, which, you know, for a family is something that strengthens you.
Did you catch crap on the playground at school too? Like, we're kids, they know that, you know, dad's running the Knicks.
All the time.
Yeah.
All the time. Knicks suck. You know, but by the way, like, my dad's, you know, was a GM of the 1994 team that went to the NBA finals. He built the 99 team that went to the finals. There was a lot of praise and adoration, and the same people are patting you on the back. It's a microcosm, right? The media, the kids on the playground were the same way. So I got a lot of great, praise for that. But yeah, when they were struggling, there was a lot of heat too.
There's actually an apt analogy there, because let me tell you, the press room is basically just like an overgrown playground. And
I didn't want to say it myself, man.
No, it's true. It's absolutely true, in all the best and worst ways. And you alluded to this. So the two finals, like the only two finals in modern Knicks history, your dad's at the helm for. Although he makes these two key trades for the '99 lockout season, acquiring Sprewell and Camby, and he's fired that season before they make the finals run. Right. I mean, there is the NBA in a nutshell, and for you. Mm-hmm. As the son of an NBA GM, I could only imagine, there it is, everything encapsulated all in one. Best run they've had now, still to this day, their last finals, it's been 22 years or whatever. But he was fired before he even got to see that through.
Yeah, it was a tough thing. It was amazing to watch the team that he built go to the finals, and the moves he made, trading for Sprewell and Camby, were of course proven out by how well those guys did. And you read the book, so you can kind of see the thread there. That for my family, it was even bigger than just a dad losing his job or even a dad losing a prominent job. My dad, when he came to America not speaking English and lost his brother, he would sit in the cheap seats at Madison Square Garden with my grandfather and watch the Knicks. He wore number 22 at Tennessee for Dave DeBuscher. Hmm. So for my family, the Knicks and that journey, it was all wrapped up in that, right? So of course that was a very difficult thing. But listen, my dad was hired by the Bucks, months later. Within a few years, that team was in Game 7 of the Eastern Conference Finals. They had great runs. He went to the Wizards and did very well. So he had just this amazing career as an executive. But that was hard.
And then, There's threads of this in the book, Dan, where clearly I think your dad's experiences, and then, obviously just by, this series of family experiences, there's a part of your dad, I think, that you can see is fueling you and your own basketball career and your drive within the book. He's taking that, of course, from his own experiences. So like the through line of basketball and your family and its roots, and some of the tragic roots, I feel that weight in the book. And again, this is one of these things that's probably subconscious for most of our lives. And then at some point you realize how these things shape us and how our family experiences and our parents and our grandparents, that there are traits that we're not even conscious of that have been kind of passed on. For you, in your basketball upbringing and in your career at Stanford, and then, obviously a terrible knee injury along the way, the drive that you had, is it clear to you looking back and the more you worked on this book, like that this is, you are channeling some aspect of your father, your grandmother, all of that is present there?
100%. And I couldn't have articulated it as clearly as a young person, but I always had this sense of what others had gone through so I could have a better life, and so you take that obligation really seriously. And also the people in the family who never got the chance, and that's real, right? Like my grandmother lost so many siblings, her parents, my uncle passing. When you grow up with kind of this veil of tragedy, like in the background, and thank God it wasn't me. I have a generation of separation from that, but it fuels you. It impacts you. It motivates you. It inspires you in certain ways. And so, and then again, like I couldn't have named it, when I was going through it all, I just knew that like I was always maniacally working and nothing was ever good enough and it was never enough and I wanted more and I wanted to work more. And I had, and I write about it in the book, I had people make comments to me, like kind of to the extent of like, what's going on with you? Cause like, what's the deal? Why are you pushing so hard? And it was, it would have been hard for me to explain. It took me 300 pages to explain it. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, you question your own sanity more pretty frequently.
Right,
in the book.
Rightfully so. There were moments there where it deserved to be questioned.
Probably never more so than in the Larry Bird story, which again I will not spoil on this podcast. People can go read the book, but I was doubled over in pain myself while reading it. So,
well, thank you. Listen, what I'll say about that, without giving away details, is one thing my grandma's really taught me is kind of like the juxtaposition of these forces in life, right? There's sadness and there's joy. There's, you know, darkness and there's light. And so in the book, I wanted to reflect those things. So there's some really hard things that I write about, but there's also a lot of really hopeful and amazing things. There's also just funny things, right? And I think that this particular story about Larry Bird is one of them. And we won't give away exactly what happened, but Howard, I hope you know that the crux of it is that I refuse to leave this man's presence. And I think for a basketball crazed person, you could respect that.
I absolutely do. And I could, like, I very much could sympathize. I knew exactly what you were feeling in that moment on more levels than we should discuss on a podcast.
There you go.
You also mentioned there is a point, you go to the ABCD camp after your junior year. You score 45 points in a critical game with Stanford watching. This is a key moment in your pre-collegiate career, or getting to your collegiate career. But it's the same year LeBron James is there, I believe. Mm-hmm. It was not clear to me from the book. Did you guys cross paths in any way? Did you ever have a LeBron intersection during that time?
I'm going to put it like this. I crossed paths with him. I don't want to say he crossed my path, because that. But no, I did. I played against him several times. At ABCD camp, we played against him, and in some AAU tournaments as well. And I have written over the course, like, I've done a lot of writing. I think I've written 4 or 5 articles about LeBron, just because I'm such a fan and admirer. And I've told some of these stories in these articles. But the first play that I saw of him, I grabbed someone. It was a college coach. I just happened to be standing next to who I knew. And I was from a far court. I saw him drive baseline and dunk the ball. And I said, "Who is that?" And he said, he was a sophomore at the time, LeBron was. He said, "That's LeBron James from Akron, Ohio. He's the best player in the country." And then from that day forward, I mean, I was calling all my friends saying, "You're not going to believe this." So I was, and I'll also tell you this, that my senior year, I was in the state of Wisconsin. I was one of the top players in the state and being heavily recruited. LeBron was the screensaver on my computer. That's what his high school, St. Vincent, St. Mary's, a picture of him. That's how big of a fan of his I was.
Wow. And did you guys ever have a chance to chit chat at all or anything along the way? Does he know that you were intersecting with him? This is obviously the, Dan Grunfeld's LeBron story. I don't know if LeBron has the equivalent Dan Grunfeld story.
You know I'm going to bet that he doesn't, but, I've never spoken to him. I've just, like most basketball fans, I've admired him. Of course, his game, and I've written about this. I actually wrote about it in Sports Illustrated, Howard. His character is something that I've always admired so much. What he does for the community, how he carries himself. I think he's just an extraordinary role model. And so I haven't chatted with him. I would welcome the opportunity if you could hook it up. You know where you can find me. But no, he's the man.
Speaking of people who are the all-time class acts and great in the community as well as on the court, Ray Allen wrote the foreword for your book. And Ray Allen, of course, has taken a great personal interest in the Holocaust himself and has written about it over the last couple of years. Tell me how you and Ray Allen connected and how he comes to write the foreword for the book.
So I know Ray because my dad was the GM of the Bucks when Ray was a young player. And I was, a shooting guard in high school. I moved, my positions moved as I got older and slower. So I ended my career as like a stretch four. That's what I knew. There was nowhere else to go. So I had to retire. But in my prime, I was a shooting guard. And, Ray was a shooting guard in Milwaukee. And so he was always so good to me. And him and my dad had a great relationship. And he has been, as you said, this amazing advocate for Holocaust remembrance, Holocaust education, so much so that I actually learned it from my grandma. I didn't know about this. And years ago, there was an article in a Jewish publication that my grandma gets, I don't subscribe to, right? And she mentioned, she said, "Hey, do you know that Ray Allen is doing all this work?" And so I just, it's so amazing what he's done. And when I, was finished with the book and we connected and I told him about the story, and he didn't hesitate to support this, and that just means the world to me. And I've told people, and it's the truth, like, Ray is one of the top 75 players in NBA history. He's an even better person. That speaks volumes to his character and who he is. And the interesting part is, for as close as he was with my family and my dad, and he'd been to our house, and they've been through these playoff battles together, and he didn't know that my dad's parents were Holocaust survivors. Because it's not something my dad really speaks about that much publicly. It's not something that he hides, but he's not going to probably volunteer that. So when I kind of told Ray the story, and it was even, I think it hit him even a little deeper, but he's incredible.
Yeah. And I know, of course, we are, as we're heading into Thanksgiving weekend here, you are home at your parents' place, and Ernie is around and can join us for a few minutes.
Yeah, absolutely.
If he wants to pop in as we wind down. What is there one thing more than anything, your overriding feeling in writing this book that not just drove you, but that you want readers to take away from it? Because it is a unique story. There are threads that it might be familiar to people, but it is a unique story. And it's very much your family's story. What's your main hope in what people can walk away from with it?
Yeah, absolutely. And my dad is coming in here to join us. Listen, I mean, I think that ultimately, and I'll let my dad say a quick hello.
Hello, Howard. How are you?
Good, Ernie. How are you? Good to see you.
Doing well.
Happy pre-Thanksgiving.
Thank you. Same to you.
I'm going to answer this question. Listen, I mean, there's a lot of difficult things in the book and in the story, but ultimately it's a story of hope, you know, and it's a happy story. Like, here we are. We're a father and son. We get to be here together today and kind of tell this intergenerational story. We just, you know, FaceTimed with my grandma earlier, who was laughing with my son. And so it's a, you know, it's a happy and hopefully an inspirational story. And my grandma has always said, just because a story is difficult doesn't mean you shouldn't tell it, you know? And so I'm very definitely happy and proud to do that.
Which is a perfect segue, Ernie, to ask you about this, because this is a story, as I mentioned to Dan earlier, I mean, me coming to New York covering the Knicks, it's after your time with the Knicks. I knew you as GM of the Bucks and then the Wizards, but I was not aware of your family story and this history. And I wonder if Dan does not decide to devote, you know, a year and a half or more to this book, is this a story that would have been told? This is obviously a very difficult one, and even more so for you than for Dan. But give me a sense of your experience of Dan deciding to kind of go down this path and saying, this is something that the world needs to read about.
Well, I mean, obviously, there's a great message in this book, but we didn't even know he was writing it. We were just talking to him, and he was talking to us about family things, you know, what happened here, what happened there. Every once in a while, he'd take notes, and I said, what are you taking notes for? He goes, hey, just so we remember. And all of a sudden, you know, he comes in one day and says, Dad, I just wrote a book. And so I'm very proud of him, because it is a difficult subject, but something that people need to know about. It's really not about me. It's about our family. And I just play basketball. You know, my mother was the one that had to go through all the hardships and all the pain. And she persevered. And she's terrific. And I think we learned from her. I think we all really learned from her. And she's a real hero. And she's the hero of the family, not us.
True.
I think that's very clear in the book that she is a hero. But I mean, as Dan and I discussed, Ernie, like, I think it's really interesting that in Dan's descriptions of himself and just his own experience, even just as a basketball player, obviously as a person as well, but there are things he's carrying with him that I think are clearly, you know, the things that you lived through, that your mother lived through, that your family kind of carries forward, and that we're not always conscious of as individuals. And do you, so I'm curious for you, do you see that in as you're reading the book, as Dan is kind of trying to pull together all these details, that in him you're seeing kind of the results of everything that the family has experienced and endured?
I think so. I think he's learned a lot. You know, I'm very proud of my son and my daughter also. You know, my kids are very accomplished because they have a great work ethic. You know, they work very hard. They're competitive. They want to achieve. And I think we got that from my mother and my father also. And then that's what I had. I had that also. And we passed it on to our children. I couldn't be prouder of them. I mean, you know, Dan, I want to brag about him a little bit, you know, but going to Stanford and Stanford Business School. And my daughter also has really, she went to Emory, and then she's a lawyer now. She went to Georgetown Law School. She's very successful in that way. But we always will carry this with us, and it's something that we don't want to forget, and we don't want people to forget. And I'm not really good at talking about it. It's very painful, obviously. There's a lot of sorrow that goes into it, but there's also a lot of love and a lot of positive things that we all learn from it.
There is, and it is an incredible balance there, the sorrow and the joy and the hope that all is kind of sewn together here. Is that what made it something that you could talk to Dan about for the book? I mean, these are things that you don't necessarily want to discuss, and some of these things are things I'm sure you don't necessarily want to relive. Did you kind of have to come to grips yourself, Ernie, with the idea that, like, there's a value here, so it's worth kind of, you know, putting myself in that mindset to talk about these things?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think I had to do that initially, you know, but once we talked about it and I talked to my mom about it and Dan about it, it's something that's it's an important message. And what happened back in the 40s in the Holocaust, it's something that people need to remember and people can't forget about. And my mom is 96 now, and God bless her. You know, she plays bridge every day and she walks every morning, and she's still there. And she's one of the few people left who still know the story, who has a story. There's a lot of people who have their own stories. You know, this story is about my family and my mother and my parents.
To the extent that this is also a basketball story, how do you see that part of it, Ernie, in terms of how it carries you from, you know, your childhood as a 8-year-old immigrant who doesn't speak the language to a prominent and successful career that lasts decades? How do you see all of those things kind of coinciding?
Well, you know, my father, I don't know if Dan told you or not, but my father was a really good athlete. He played soccer, he played ping pong, but he was a huge fan of everything. And he'd always take me to games. And basketball for me was going down to the park. I couldn't speak English. I was almost 9 when we came here. I couldn't speak a word of English. And my parents both worked 10, 12 hours a day. So I was by myself most of the time, and I'd go down to the park, try to make friends. It's hard to make friends when you don't speak the language, but I was a good athlete, and I could do things on the basketball court, and I was more accepted, and I got more friends because I did play the game, and I was good at it, and it just kept going. But initially, the reason I started playing is really to make friends and to be accepted in the neighborhood.
By the end, he had a lot of friends.
even before the NBA career, that before the everybody's all of a sudden like now wants, oh wow, yeah, now you're Ernie Grunfeld from the neighborhood, now we love you.
Well, you know, I became a pretty good player.
Yeah,
I was a high school All-American, I was a college All-American, won an Olympic gold medal, and obviously played in the NBA for 9 years. But you know, I still have some of those friends actually that I met when I was young. I'm from my park, Austin Street Playground, by the way.
that's phenomenal. And it is such, even that part of the story I thought was just so resonant, because we think about basketball as being a city game. I've lived here in New York now for 17 years. And so you get that, and it almost becomes mythological, where you don't quite, you sometimes think like this is being exaggerated. Oh, New York's such a basketball city and all this stuff. And it feels sometimes a little bit over romanticized perhaps. But even in reading Dan's account, Ernie, of your childhood and how basketball is that outlet, and the connections it makes, the salvation on some levels it provides, you realize like this is not just the mythology of New York. Like there's a real aspect of this here.
There's no question. I mean, that's how we hung out. We hung out at the park. We played at the park. We did whatever. We played stickball. We played football. We played everything at the park. But that was our social life. You know, we didn't have computers and we didn't have things of that nature. There were only 3 TV channels, so there weren't too many things you could watch on TV. So if you wanted to socialize, you had to go down, and that was our group. You know, and it wasn't just our group. There were a lot of different groups. If you go down to the park, my park anyway, at 6:20, there was nobody there. At 6:30, it was full. Maybe 150 people would be there immediately right after dinner, and you had to play. And if you wanted to play, you had to stay on the court. So I think that's why a lot of the players who are from New York are very competitive, because if you lost, you might have to wait 45 minutes to an hour to play again. So that was the life that I grew up in, on the playgrounds, on the concrete.
And what about now? How much basketball, you guys are together for a little while here, down in DC, like how much basketball are you guys all consuming together? Are there any other channels even allowed on the Grunfeld family TV?
Yeah, Sesame Street. This is Sun's here.
Yeah. We watch more Sesame Street. That's a good point.
That's a tough.
We still watch balance. A lot of games. You know, we enjoy the game. We really love the game, both of us. We watch college games also. We saw a great one last night in UCLA and Gonzaga. So we do that, and that's something that we share, and then we do that together. But Sesame Street is also big on our list right now.
We share that too.
Sesame Street also with great New York roots, obviously. So that's you
right.
know,
good time.
It all kind of comes together. Ernie, I'll just close on this one. It's the last question I was asking Dan about before you came in. Just this is a very personal story on a lot of levels, and it's got a lot of layers to it. But it is also a story with a lot of universal themes to it. I'm just curious. I know you've read it as well. So as this goes to the general public, whether they are basketball fans or just interested in an incredible family story, what is the one thing you kind of hope people can take away from this?
Well, I think it shows a lot of perseverance. It shows a lot of love. And it shows that no matter what happens, you have to move forward and you have to survive. And it's a story of survival and all those things put together and love.
And it is in many subtle ways along the way, or not so subtle times, also a basketball story. It's all there. It's really incredible. Again, folks, it's By the Grace of the Game, The Holocaust, A Basketball Legacy, and an Unprecedented American Dream by Dan Grunfeld. It's really powerful. And also, by the way, again, I should note, it's a lot of fun in a lot of places, too. There's so many great stories in here. Dan, Ernie, wonderful to see you both. Thank you for spending the time. Dan, thank you for writing this. Folks, go find it on, I assume, Amazon and all the usual places, yes?
Everywhere books are sold.
happy Thanksgiving to you and your family, and thanks again for joining us today.
Awesome. Howard, thanks so much for having us. Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy holidays, Howard. Nice seeing you.
Okay, that's it for today's show. My thanks again to Dan Grunfeld and to Ernie Grunfeld for joining us. Go order Dan's book, By the Grace of the Game, wherever you buy books. Thank you to our producer, Shelby Royston. Thank you all for listening. Remember, you can hear Chris Mannix and me every Tuesday on The Crossover with all the latest NBA chatter. And then on Fridays, it's me and a guest. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to The Crossover wherever you get your podcasts. Go subscribe to the Sports Illustrated Podcast channel on YouTube. And please hit me with all your feedback on Twitter at Howard Beck.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.